Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with writers in the studios of North State Public Radio. Now here's your host, Nancy Wiegman.
Rachel Michelberg earned a Bachelor of Music degree in vocal performance from San Jose State University and has performed leading roles in musicals and opera. She still performs occasionally, but mostly spends her time gardening, hiking, and training the next generation of singers. When her two children were young, today's guest got a call that her husband's plane had crashed and he had a traumatic brain injury that left him irrational, unable to manage bodily functions, and seizure-prone. Rachel Michelberg has now written a riveting account of her struggle to sustain herself and her family after this tragic event. The title is Crash, How I Became a Reluctant Caregiver. Rachel Michelberg, welcome.
Thank you so much, Nancy. It's great to be here.
In the first chapter of your book, you tell us about your husband, David. You say he grew up in Munich, Germany. And then you also tell us about yourself. And this happens, the scene is over a dinner in Palo Alto that you're telling him about yourself. And I'd like for you to read what you have to say in that first chapter.
Sure. I was a little embarrassed by my comfy suburban childhood in nearby Sunnyvale. But I was enthusiastic about my role in Norma, the opera I was rehearsing. I also have two day jobs. I do administrative work for a Jewish charity, and I'm a synagogue cantor. That's more of a nights and weekends thing, though. Wait, did you sing at the Holocaust Memorial Service last year? The one in Saratoga? Yes, I was the one who sang in Hungarian, I grimaced. Definitely not in my cadre of comfortable languages. I was there. I thought you were so hot, but I didn't think it would be appropriate to hit on the cantor. We laughed. This would be a story retold with delight. As first dates go, it was good. He was smart, attractive, attentive. He drove an older chocolate brown Mercedes convertible. His lilting soft Bavarian accent was seductive, and his exotic European stories promised me access to the world beyond Silicon Valley. Most important, he wanted to see me again. This could be all right.
This is author Rachel Michelberg reading from her her book, Crash, How I Became a Reluctant Caregiver. And in this scene, you're describing and you're in the restaurant with David, and this is your first date, is it not, with David?
Yes, it's the first date. And in fact, it was a blind date. Although, as you heard in the excerpt, blind on my part, but he had seen me, which was a little unfair, but we actually did laugh quite a bit over that.
Well, he was quite an accomplished guy. He had a Fulbright. He spent a year, I think, in San Diego on a Fulbright scholarship. And so he's quite an intelligent guy that you're meeting. But now, you had been married before.
No, I had not. I had been engaged before, but I had married. Right. Yes. And we were both in our mid-30s, and I was quite ready to start a family, get married and start a family.
So you get together with David, who his first language is German because he was born and he grew up in Munich, Germany. And then everything seems to be going fine, but you end chapter one with saying that after he gave you a diamond ring, because you got engaged on Valentine's Day. How romantic, Rachel. He gives you this
yes.
diamond ring, and you say, my perfect simple diamond stays hidden at the bottom of my jewelry box during the awful years, the lawsuits, my hospitalizations, family feuds, stalking and vandalism, mom's illness and death. So this is how you end chapter one. You give us kind of a preview of coming attractions, if I may call it that. And this sounds, can all these things happen to one human being? This just sounds incredible that these things happen to you.
Yes, it's, I often say, you know, you don't make this stuff up. The confluence of all of these events, and it really did happen within a few years, just after David's accident. And just to explain, to foreshadow a little bit without giving too much away, our marriage had been okay, but we had been starting to have some difficulties prior to the accident, some struggles, and I wasn't happy. It's highly likely he wasn't happy either. And I had started to stray a bit. I had started to fall for someone else, and hence the some of those issues that you mentioned became quite escalated shortly after the accident happened, and for those years succeeding it. So it was a pretty intense time. You referenced my hospitalizations. I had clearly some stress-related conditions that landed me in the hospital shortly after David's accident as well. So I was in quite a weakened state at that time, which was part of the reason that I was given the option by the social worker to not to take him home right away, which I was horrified to imagine that's something I would do is to not care for him. But because of my weakened state, there was quite a bit of encouragement from the professionals who encourage me to go in that direction, to at least temporarily not become his caregiver, take him home, have him in the house.
Before we get there, let's go back and let people know what actually happened. The two of you have been married a few years, you had a couple of very young children, and you're sitting there watching TV, and you get a phone call.
Right. I get a phone call, and of course, thinking it was him saying, "We just landed, I'll be right home." He had been on a one-day work trip, and they had taken a private plane just because it's fun to do that. And on the way back, when I answered the phone, I discovered that he had been in this plane crash. A crash landed into a vineyard in the Central Coast, on the Central Coast area. And I was to come down immediately to be with him in the hospital. And
he was actually had a pilot's license himself. He'd been suspended, so he was not the pilot. There was another guy in the plane with him that went down. So they both were sent to the hospital.
Correct. David's license had been suspended because he just hadn't been flying that much, and you need to sustain certain number of hours. But the other gentleman was flying, and his injuries were severe, but he did not sustain any head injuries. David, on the other hand, did. And you know, it's hard to imagine that anybody can survive a plane crash, but they didn't know they were landing in a vineyard. They thought they were landing in a field. And so they were quite close to the ground. And of course, the cabling of the vineyard, the landing gear caught in the cabling of the vineyard. And they weren't wearing shoulder belts, which is really the main cause of the brain injury, because David's head hit the instrument panel.
Yeah, so he was thrown against the instrument panel, and his head suffered this traumatic injury. In fact, they took him first to a hospital closer by and then said, our small hospital, we can't handle this case. We're going to have to send him to San Luis Obispo, wasn't it?
Yes, exactly. The accident happened in a smaller town called Paso Robles, wine country, you know, but they did not have a neurosurgery service there. So he was transported to another hospital.
So you call your sister and say, come over and be with the kids. You had a little boy and a little girl. Stay with them, and off you went. And who did you go with on this? It took you about 3 hours, did it?
Yeah, three and a half hours. The wife of the pilot, she was pregnant at the time, also had a small child at home. She got a friend of hers to drive the two of us down there in the middle of the night. Yeah, we arrived about 1, 2 a.m., I think.
Well, I would like for you to read what you're told when you get there, that what the situation was like. They first mispronounced your name, but so would you read that section where you're told that your husband's condition is very critical?
Yes, and this is, just to clarify, this is when we are in the car and I'm on the phone with the nursing staff at the hospital. Your husband is very critical. There's severe damage to his skull, most likely internal organs as well. We're a small hospital. We don't have a neurosurgery service, so we're transporting him to San Luis Obispo. Brain surgery? We're just trying to keep him alive. Oh my God. Get here as soon as you can. I tell Miri and her friend what I've learned. She's also been on the phone. Her husband is not as critical as David, but he has severe back injuries. He'll stay at the Paso Robles Clinic. They understand that David's trauma is more critical, so they'll take me on to San Luis Obispo and then return to Paso Robles to see her husband, Yaron. I call my brother, Paul. He insists on driving from Mill Valley, north of San Francisco, to meet me at the hospital. I call the rabbi, who happens to be my boss, at the synagogue where I'm the cantor. I won't be at work the next day. I ask him to pray for us, even though Jews don't usually do that. I stare out the car window into the blackness. There's no beauty of the spring green hills to distract me.
I might add that
at 1:30 a.m., we pull up to the...
When you're talking about the spring, it's because it is April. This is April of 2005.
Yes, exactly, April 19th. At 1:30 a.m., we pull up to the ER at Sierra Vista Regional. I scramble out of the car after a quick thanks to Miri and her friend. I promise to keep in touch. You have my husband, David Michaelberg? The ER receptionist directs me to the ICU. The tiny waiting room is empty. Please ring the buzzer for service, reads a sign on the wall next to the door. The ICU door opens, and I rush inside. A nurse stops me outside a curtained area and pats her hand. A nurse stops me outside a curtained area and puts her hand on my shoulder. Mrs. Michaelberg, I need to warn you, you may not recognize him. ICUs have a timeless quality, like casinos, hushed voices, constant motion, lots of noise. The whoosh of respirators. Rhythmic beeping of monitors, like a semi backing up. Watch out, your life is moving in reverse. I know he'll be bandaged and swollen, connected to machines and IVs. Grey's Anatomy is my current can't-miss show. Before that, ER and St. Elsewhere, so I'm somewhat of a trauma expert. Beep, beep. I nod. I understand.
This is Rachel Michaelberg, and she's reading from her book, Crash, How I Became a Reluctant Caregiver. Her husband has been in a plane crash. The obvious injury is traumatic brain injury. So you can see the head injury, the head trauma. And they think, too, maybe internal organs. Turns out the pancreas suffered, and 3 vertebrae in his lower back were shattered, and they're not sure if he'll be blind. At least one of his eyes are affected. So you are talking to your brother and say, I don't know if I should want him to live or hope that he dies. What kind of life can he have with that kind of injury? And I'm sure those of us reading your book are thinking that along with you, Rachel.
Yes.
That what would you hope if I were in that situation? Would I want to live like that, or would I prefer to die? And you don't know.
No.
Don't know what his life will be like.
No.
Or what your life will be like.
Exactly. And with brain injuries, they just don't know how much cognitive function you will regain. There's no way to predict it. They did tell me that because David was highly educated and was very active and his brain was highly developed, that he would likely regain more function than someone who was not in that situation. But still, he had such a severe injury, basically his skull was cracked open from the bridge of his nose to the top of his head. And the frontal lobe controls our emotion, our impulsivity. They couldn't tell me. It was really quite a wait and see situation.
My guest is Rachel Michaelberg, author of Crash, How I Became a Reluctant Caregiver. We'll be back to continue our conversation after a short break. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wiegman. I'm Nancy Wiegman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, author and vocal trainer, Rachel Michaelberg, author of Crash, How I Became a Reluctant Caregiver. Well, that was the night of April 19th of 2005, and then you go in to see him the next morning, and I'd like for you to read this scene in your book where you start by saying, I make my way to the bedside tentatively. Okay. And this is the next day.
I make my way to the bedside tentatively. There is one nurse left checking monitors, the respirator, IVs, fluid levels. I'm afraid to touch him. He can't hear me, right? She smiles. Not really, but you should talk to him anyway. We think it helps with the healing. Healing? That seems like a pretty far-fetched idea. David looks about the same as he did last night, except the bloody bandages have been replaced with clean ones. Barely recognizable. So much swelling. So many tubes. Will it be months? Years? Ever? Even if he survives, who will my husband be? Who will I be? My roles are clearly defined, and I do them pretty well. A mother and wife, yes, but mainly I think of myself as a professional classical and theater singer and a cantor. Pretty self-centered occupations. But you don't get leading opera roles bearing your soul and talent in front of hundreds of people by focusing on others. You have to like attention, almost crave it. You have to spend countless hours practicing and rehearsing. Although I always intended to have children, I had not prepared for the supreme selflessness parenting requires. Back to school night? You have to miss rehearsal. You're sick and feel like crap? You still have to get out of bed, make the kids breakfast and a bag lunch, and schlep them to school. You want those beautiful suede boots? You buy your daughter shoes instead, since she outgrows them every 2 minutes, and buying both just isn't in the budget. I resent my kids on occasion. Parenting is not a constant thrill. But I accept the role and forge ahead, constantly trying to find the balance, walking the tightrope between my needs and theirs. I'm learning to find joy in their accomplishments, not just in mine. But I'm not a natural caretaker, like David's mother, Maria, or his sister, Dora. How can I possibly become David's nursemaid?
This is Rachel Michaelberg reading from Crash, How I Became a Reluctant Caregiver. And in your book, Rachel, you don't hide the flaws. You just put them right out there. And you mentioned that, you know, even before David's accident, you were kind of moving apart from each other, and you found this other guy interesting. So you admit that. And then in this section you just read, you say sometimes you resent your kids. And a parent's not supposed to say that, Rachel.
No.
But you, and you say parenting is not a constant thrill. But you accept that role and you forge ahead, as you say, trying to find a balance between your needs and theirs. And you mentioned a little bit earlier that you were hospitalized yourself. How did that come about?
Yes. So I have a condition called diverticulitis that flares up periodically. And I had a very, very bad attack about 6 weeks after David's accident. So it was so bad that I had to go into the hospital. And David was in one hospital and I was in another, and the kids during this awful time were being taken care of by family and friends. So there's no question that the stress of the, of that time period, was a major factor in that attack. So, it was a pretty awful time.
And you don't, there's so much you do not know. And you even quote in German that fact that you just don't know. I'm looking, Rachel, at the top of page 39. Mm-hmm. And you have so many questions and nobody has the answers to these important questions. Would you read the couple of paragraphs here at the top of that page 39?
I grow to love the nurses who patiently answer my barrage of questions. How long will he be here? Where will he go after this? Will he remember us? Will he be able to dress and feed himself? And the all-consuming question, if he doesn't return to normal, what will he be like? The answer is always the same. We just don't know. Schauen wir mal.
So that's how you kind of conclude your chapter 4. And then you start chapter 5 with David just coming out of surgery when you get back to San Luis Obispo in the ICU. And he has other family members there. Who are they?
Dora, David's sister, and Siggy, or Sigmund, David's brother. Siggy came from Munich, and Dora, who had moved to Israel when she was 18, she came from Israel, so they had flown out to be there with us.
So how are they? Are they critical of how you are managing David's life and care?
Or well, not at that point. At that point, we were all sort of, we almost moved into the ICU we were staying in a motel nearby and just in there constantly to get updates on his situation, to hold his hand, to just be there. And so at this point, he was in an induced coma because he had back injuries. They wanted to keep him immobile, and his injuries were so severe that I felt that they could control his care much better by keeping him on a ventilator and staying in the coma. So at that point, we were all fine with each other. We were supportive of each other. There was no thought at that point of my not taking care of him for the long term.
You mentioned that they kept him in a coma, and then after the coma, they still wanted him to not move. And you say they made him a torso brace that he had to wear every day, all day long, for about 10 weeks.
Correct.
It's like a big clamshell that he had to wear 24/7, this torso brace. And it was uncomfortable, but that's what had to be done.
Mm-hmm.
So during this time, you're wondering, okay, what is life going to be like? What should I do? And you have a scene where you start the scene by saying, "Lois saves my life." And this is on page 81. "It could be argued that I saved my own life. I make the decision, but Lois opens the door and I go through it. Her permission is my get out of jail free card." What did you mean by that, Rachel?
Oh, yeah, this is a crucial scene in the book. This changed the tide for me when I was confronting this future of being David's full-time caregiver and being the single parent to our two children who at that time were 6 and 7 years old. And I was terrified. I was absolutely beside myself with fear and over what would my life be like? How could I be a good parent? How can I not be resentful most of the time? And in the scene, Lois gives me the option for him to go into a different facility, to go from the hospital into a brain injury rehab facility, a residential rehab facility. And so that's what, and I think I'm going to read my reaction to her.
Yeah, would you pick up and read? Yes, please.
"There's a facility in Gilroy called Learning Services. It's out in the country, kind of like a ranch. It's run by a lovely person, Dr. Jill Weingartner. She's Jewish, I think. Lois studies me. She looks like you. I think you'd really like her." It shouldn't have been reassuring that the director is Jewish, but it is. Lois is throwing me a lifeline, but all I can think about is Dr. Weingartner and I comparing matzo ball soup recipes. Lois opens a folder. A brochure slides across the table. "She's been preparing for this conversation. She's been tracking my reality. I haven't been alone. They have a day program as well as a live-in, but I'd recommend that David start with a few months in residence." So gentle, but so firm. "But," she holds up her hand, "just so you can regain your strength." I allow myself to glance at the brochure, but quickly avert my eyes from that gateway to moral depravity. Yet something shifts. In an instant, I know I'm dangerously capable of considering her suggestion, barely suspecting that my role as the heroine, the ingenue, the victim, is about to be usurped, just like Betty Davis in All About Eve. This can work. No, it can't. David can't go into an institution. Crazy people go into institutions, put there by selfish relatives who can't handle a little extra work. I can see the evil twin peeking from behind the curtain, stage left. The twin who would protest. "What about me? What about my life, my needs, my happiness? Don't I matter?" Lois watches me wavering. She seizes her chance. "Your kids are so young. They are traumatized too. They need a lot of support. The demands on you are going to be enormous. It would be insanely difficult in the best of circumstances, but you're weak, you're drained. You have no idea how often I've seen perfectly healthy caretakers implode from the stress." She moves in for the kill. "If you can't do it for yourself or David, do it for Hannah and Joshi."
This is Rachel Michaelberg. She's reading from Crash, How I Became a Reluctant Caregiver. And Lois concludes her presentation, if I want to call it that, by saying, "If you can't do it for yourself or your husband, do it for your children, Hannah and Joshi." So when she says that, like you said, this is a turning point in your thinking. You were thinking it was up to you, you're going to have to do all this. And she recognizes that your health is suffering from this. You're drained. And you also go into another problem that you had when you were younger, and I don't know if it resurfaced, but you had an eating disorder, Rachel.
Yes. These kinds of disorders are, they never really leave you. It had lain latent in me when I had this experience in college. And the eating disorder actually perked up its ugly head again before the accident. It actually started when I realized that I was falling in love with someone else. And so it just progressed dramatically after the accident. Yeah, that was a rough time. And luckily, I got over it.
Well, compounding all this that you're going through, this is a huge amount of guilt. So many times, Rachel, you mention you're guilty about something. What were some of the things that generated this feeling, these feelings of guilt?
Yeah, so just to continue with what you had, your previous question about the about Lois's get out of jail free card, initially I agreed to a temporary delay of David coming home. That's what I believed at the time that I was agreeing to, and I was. And yet, as time went on, I came to realize that it would actually be impossible for me to care for him and our children and myself and maintain my sanity. So the guilt is a recurring theme in my story, because I had always been taught that to do the right thing, to take care of people, to honor your responsibilities, to not shirk duties, especially when they're hard. And that's what I believed to be right, and I still believe that. And so it felt to me, it seemed to me that the right thing to do would be to take David home and become his full-time caregiver and just assume that role, to assume that role that had been thrust upon me. And as I say, that became clear over these next several months that it just wasn't going to be possible for me to do that.
So any wife would have enough in her hands caring for a husband in this condition. But you have two children, and they also, they're problems that you have to address with both of these adorable children that you love. And you mentioned your daughter, Hannah, you say she's pure compassion. But what was she dealing with? Because she had therapy. You say you book her a therapy appointment the next day after this interchange with her. And why were you taking Hannah to therapy?
Yes. So Hannah caught me crying one night, and I was actually crying. It felt like I was crying most of the time during that time. I wouldn't say I tried to hide it from them. I tried to keep things as normal as possible for them. So, I made an attempt to reserve my tears for when, they weren't around, but she did catch me, and she advised me that I didn't need to cry on the outside. I could cry on the inside, and that's what she does.
And she's just a little kid.
Seven.
That's pretty mature for a little seven-year-old. Yeah. Saying that.
Hannah is emotionally so aware. She is just amazing. And at the same time, she had quite a bit of anxiety. She was very fearful. And as the story progresses and some pretty awful, more awful things happened to our family, she became even more anxious. And then my son, Joshua, who was a year and a half younger, is on the autism spectrum. He's
which you first didn't want to believe. You kept trying to say, no, that can't be true. But you were confronted with, yes, it is true that your son is on the autism spectrum. Mm-hmm. After a break, Rachel Michaelberg and I will continue our conversation about how she became a reluctant caregiver. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with the author of Crash, How I Became a Reluctant Caregiver. I mentioned your honesty in telling your story that we would like to hear as a reader, everything. You were so selfless and you were powerful and you did all the right things with all the right intentions. And yet there's a point when you say, I hate David for doing this to me. I hate Mark. That was the guy that you had wanted to see. I hate Mark for keeping a hold on my heart. Most of all, I hate myself for being so powerless. So you're honest with your feelings in this. Did you get criticism at the time for people saying, well, Rachel, just buck up and do what you need to do?
You know, I didn't get people confronting me with that directly, but I heard particularly friends and family in Germany and some in Israel who were saying that to each other. I did lose a few friends through this. It wasn't like they refused to speak to me, but I sensed the coldness. That was hard. You know, as a trained actress, I think I'm comfortable really delving deep into what's underneath the surface stuff. And when I wrote this, I wanted to be, my goal was to be as honest as possible, because people who are confronted with traumas like this, we hear so much about heroism and, you know, they rose to the occasion and they became better people because they discovered strength they didn't know they had. But that wasn't my story. You know, I did discover strength I didn't know I had, but it wasn't the strength to take on this role of caregiver. It was a different kind of strength.
My guest is Rachel Michelberg, and her book is Crash, How I Became a Reluctant Caregiver. There's a scene when you go to the DMV, because David can't drive in this condition, and so you get this letter announcing that his driver's license must be surrendered. Would you read that scene for us, Rachel?
Yes. A letter arrives announcing that David's driver's license must be surrendered to the DMV by a certain date. Not handed over, surrendered, as if David has committed a crime. I don't procrastinate. He's never going to sit behind the wheel of a car again. Not if he's incapable of controlling impulses nor remembering to use the toilet. At the DMV, I'm directed to a window with a short line. I glance at the bored, frustrated people waiting in other lines, the young mother trying to entertain a squirmy toddler, the suited business guy on his phone, the nervous teenager about to take her driving test. Next customer, the clerk drones. Hi, I'm supposed to turn in my husband's license. He extends his hand without looking up. Do you have a letter? I give it to him. License, please. His eyes stay on the computer screen. I dig in my purse, his smooth, crevasse-free forehead. Tears well. The clerk reaches for the license, but I don't let it go. This is really hard. It's my husband. His name is David. He was in a plane crash. He's a brain injury. He'll never drive again. I struggle to hold in the deluge, uselessly. I'm having yet another meltdown. The clerk looks like he would prefer to be anywhere else. I fish for a tissue in my purse. I'm sorry. I didn't know this would be so hard. David can't do anything by himself. He's only 45. He can't even be left alone. The clerk glances around. He's not an adult anymore. Do you need to sit down? God, I'm making a scene. No, thanks. I'm okay. Sorry. TMI, I guess. A little snort escapes, a laugh cry. Pull yourself together. Do you need anything else? I'm feeling a little sorry for the clerk, alone with this crazy lady. He pushes a piece of paper toward me. Sign this release form, please. I sign and blow my nose. Next in line. Dismissed. I start to leave. I turn back. The clerk is already helping the next person. I look at the young mother, her toddler examining his bag of goldfish crackers. He used to be a really good driver, I say to no one in particular.
This is author and performer, opera and musicals, Rachel Michelberg, reading a scene from Crash, How I Became a Reluctant Caregiver. And what did you want us to take from this, you're recounting this scene, Rachel? The reader, what should we gather from this?
You know, it was the simplest acts that seemed to affect me. This is one of the most difficult moments that I remember from the whole experience. I had lots of them, but this one in particular, it was such a physical act. And, you know, we often have to meet the challenge of asking a parent, an elderly parent, to stop driving. It happened with my mother when she was sick with cancer, there's a time when people need to stop driving. And that is such a momentous event to give up that right, because you're giving up your independence. And of course, it wasn't David surrendering his license. It was me taking that license and physically taking it to the DMV and turning it in. And it was truly the end of an era for him as an adult, with the responsibilities and the freedom and the independence that adulthood offers us. And so it surprised me how emotional I became in that DMV office, which, as we know, is one of the most unemotional places you can be. And so I think that's why the surprise at how just overwhelmed I felt at that moment.
It's almost like being ambushed by an emotion that you didn't anticipate. I mean, going down to the DMV should be a very unemotional event. You just turn in the license. But I can understand that. And I think people who have lost someone, my husband died of cancer 7 years ago. And sometimes I just open a closet and see something that brings back a flood of memories. So I can understand how just something as simple as going to the DMV could really be an emotional event for you. You mentioned just now your mother.
Yes,
so you're taking care of your husband, your two children, and now your mother. What happened with your mother?
So my mother had been diagnosed with pancreatic cancer 3 years earlier, and she had survived, which is quite unusual. And the cancer returned about a year after David's accident. And by that time, it became clear that they could maybe try to prolong her life, but it was highly unlikely that she would survive this second when the cancer recurred. So we spent that year preparing for that event to happen. And it was pretty devastating. My siblings and I are very, very close to our mother. And it was just so much loss all at once.
Well, you mentioned preparing during that time. And one of the preparations involved the fact that your mother would not be around when Hannah grew old enough for her bat mitzvah. And what did you do to kind of ease that transition?
Nancy, I can't hear you.
I said, your mother was not going to be around for Hannah's bat mitzvah, and you took some steps to kind of ease that transition. What did you do?
Yes, we We bought Hannah a tallit, which is a prayer shawl that traditionally, at least at our synagogue, is given to the bar or bat mitzvah student at the ceremony. And it's quite moving. It's quite a moving moment. It's almost wrapping the child in the faith, if you will, sort of a metaphor for that. And I was trying to find a way for my mother to experience that because we knew she wasn't going to survive until the bat mitzvah would happen. So I bought Hannah a tallit and we took it to my mother who was already, she was at home, but in hospice care. And she, we had that little ceremony right there in her living room where we put the tallit on over Hannah's shoulders and we recited the prayer. And there wasn't a dry eye in the house. It was quite wonderful that that we could bring that experience to my mother before she passed. And now whenever Hannah puts on her tallit, she remembers that moment.
Well, you had so much to deal with during this time in your life, and you got criticism for wanting to put David in this kind of assisted living, if I call it that, because you could not take care of him at home. So you have all these things you're dealing with, but you still were able to perform and enjoy your music. And what way did you express your musical talents?
Yeah, so I was pretty well entrenched in that community, so I didn't actually have to do a lot of auditioning at that time. So I turned to the activity that used to give me lots of pleasure, which was the singing and the performing. It was hard though, because I had to get childcare every time. I had to create the time to study the music and to practice the music. And so it was a struggle. But I did do some local opera productions, and I believe I did some music directing, which was a little bit easier because as a music director, I directed children's shows. So that way my own kids could be involved in the shows, and we could do it together as a family. So that was very helpful.
This plane crash was in 2005, April 2005, and your children were young at the time, but they've had a chance now, enough time has passed that they have grown up. Well, you know, for such a distressing story, it does seem like it has as happy an ending as it could have. And I will remind readers, the title of your book is Crash, How I Became a Reluctant Caregiver. The author is Rachel Michaelberg. Thank you, Rachel.
Thank you, Nancy.
And now a commentary by Richard Parker, who has the best dog in the world.
I, like every other dog owner, have the best dog in the world. My guy is a 9-year-old Doberman who comes in at an even 100 pounds. He's my first Dobie, although I've wanted one for quite a long time, and when I was told some people nearby had a new litter and were willing to sell the pups without any papers, I went to look. I wanted a dog, not a folder full of dog papers. The pups were too young to leave their mom, and they all looked about alike, so we painted the toenails of the one I selected with fingernail polish, and I came back to fetch him a week or two later. I named my puppy Joby, after a favorite Gypsy Kings song, Joby Joba. And yeah, I know, Joby the Doby, altogether too cute, but them's the breaks. There's something Joby does that has puzzled me for a long time. He just gets all excited whenever I get home from wherever I might have gone. I would expect it maybe, because I'm a pretty good dog owner, if I'd been gone for a week. But even a trip to the Safeway gets the same kind of enthusiastic welcome when I approach the front door. I thought at first that Joby was just super fond of me, of course. Always take the most flattering explanation if nothing else is obvious. But then a few weeks ago, and I don't remember whether someone mentioned it to me or whether I read it somewhere, but I heard that when a dog owner leaves the house, the dog believes, or suspicions, or at least wonders whether the dog owner might never be coming back. Well, the thought of the person who loads his food bowl twice a day, never coming back, must strike fear in the heart and the stomach of my Joby. So that is the unflattering, and probably true, explanation of his excitement in seeing me. What I wonder about is why Joby doesn't produce a simple inductive argument of the following sort. My human has left the house many times, and he has always returned. Therefore, when he leaves the house the next time, he will return. That seems simple enough, doesn't it? But maybe it isn't that he can formulate this in his Joby brain. It may be that he's heard about the chicken that Bertrand Russell once wrote about. This chicken expected to be fed whenever it saw the farmer approach the barnyard, because the farmer had always fed the chickens when he came to the barnyard. Except finally, one day the farmer came to the barnyard and instead of feeding it, he wrung the chicken's neck and took it in the house to cook. Well, so much for believing the future will always be like the past. Joby could have learned the same lesson from reading David Hume, but I figure it's more likely he heard about the chicken. At any rate, it pleases me that such a noble doggie is happy to see me, whatever he's thinking, even if I'm just coming back from the Safeway. This is Richard Parker.
I would also like to thank my first guest, Rachel Michelberg, author of Crash.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.